In the fall of 1968, my then 26-year-old mother, Ellen Willis, was on her way to San Francisco with her boyfriend to visit their mutual friends, Fred and Jenny. She read about the Miss America protest in the newspaper and was dubious. "Won't people think they're just ugly, jealous women?" she wrote in a diaristic chronicle of the early women's movement. "Even so," she continued, "I remember what it's like to be examined and compared at a party, and I'm proud that women are in the papers for fighting." When my mother arrived in California, Jenny gave her a copy of Notes from the First Year. "It disturbs me," she wrote at the time. "All our problems aren't caused by men. Are they?" The tone strikes me as frighteningly bitter, especially about sexual relationships. "Either I've been remarkably lucky, or they've been unlucky, or maybe I let men who give me a hard time off the hook too easily." Though she was skeptical, she agreed to go to a women's meeting with Jenny. It was chaotic and unfocused, but she was impressed by the sheer fact of women organizing a meeting to talk. During earlier attempts at activism, she'd gone to a few Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, meetings, and donned a SNCC button in the mid-60s. She'd always detected aloof suspicion from the men, which in turn made her feel insecure. Here, she felt welcome, like she didn't have to prove herself. She resolved to join the women's movement as soon as she got home to New York. At the time, Ellen was working as a freelance writer and living in the East Village, a stone's throw from those women's meetings. The group was now convening every Thursday at the offices of the Civil Rights Organization Southern Conference Educational Fund, where Carol Hainish worked. Ellen had been in that neighborhood since 1966, shortly after she left her husband. She'd married him at 20 years old against her better judgment, in an era when getting married was still considered essential to being a woman. Her cousin Judy, who was as close to her as a sister, remembers Ellen explaining her wedding as little more than an airline ticket. She was about to graduate from Barnard and was dating Henry, who at the time was a student at Columbia. The way Ellen saw it, marriage was the only socially acceptable way she could accompany him to Berkeley, California. At their wedding, she had a sullen look on her face. She gave it a good faith effort with cooking and cleaning, doing what Judy called the real wifely bit, but she hated it. One night, she was out to dinner with Judy, along with a married couple who were friends of Henry's. The conversation turned to domesticity, and at one point, the wife leaned over to Ellen and said, "But don't you just love it?" Ellen didn't protest out loud. In 1962, no real woman would publicly admit they hated being a wife. But the look on her face was one of pure horror. The couple had moved from New York to Berkeley to Washington, D.C., where Henry was preparing for the Foreign Service. They were fighting all the time, and Henry was snubbing Ellen in the bedroom. Feeling miserable and stifled, she had a rapturous, short-lived affair with another Foreign Service trainee and immediately told Henry about it, her way of making a break. The marriage was over. She was free. Ellen moved back to New York, rented a studio in the East Village, and got an editorial job at a quarterly magazine called Fact, famous for having been sued by Barry Goldwater. She presently began dating Bob, a journalist who'd gone to junior high school with her back in Queens. A very cocky guy who delighted in debating her, he served as a kind of countercultural spirit guide. He brought her around to his artsy friends. After turning down an assignment about Bob Dylan at Commentary, he suggested to his editor that Ellen write it instead. Her 7,000 words on Dylan's artistic transformation later turned heads at two publishing houses and The New Yorker, where she soon became the magazine's pop music critic. Eventually, Ellen moved into a rent-controlled apartment downtown, and Bob moved in shortly afterward. After her 1968 California trip with Bob, Ellen met the women behind Notes, who were nothing like my fantasies of anti-sex fanatics, she wrote. They seem no different from other women, except friendlier. In the first few months, Sheehan Shulamith Firestone, who would publish the feminist classic The Dialectic of Sex less than 2 years later, formed a breakout group called Red Stockings. They planned their first action in the spring of 1969, a 300-person abortion speakout at a church in Greenwich Village, inspired by a New York State Legislative Committee hearing on abortion the month before, whose quote-unquote experts had consisted of 14 men and a nun. By then, Ellen had fully crossed the Rubicon. "Consciousness raising has one terrible result," she wrote in the same diaristic account of the period. "It makes you more conscious." Suddenly, she was noticing every catcall on the street, every condescending "dear," every time men wouldn't clear their own plates at a dinner party. The women's movement also ended up affecting what used to be called my private life. Certain things she'd taken for granted about her relationship with Bob, their mentor neophyte dynamic, his displays of male aggression, were now bathed in the harsh light of her new awareness. She began to have her own doubt seeds about their conventional dyad, doubts that came to a head in the fall of 1969. She planned to move to Colorado Springs with Bob for several months to help organize a GI coffeehouse project near the military base there. Because Bob had to travel for a reporting trip, she arrived a couple of weeks before he did. In that time, Ellen had a magical, erotic acid trip in the mountains with a younger guy named Steve, a mellow hippie with long strawberry blonde hair who had been convicted of draft resistance that summer and was expecting to go to jail any day.